Hi, and welcome to the Political Science Podcast, No Problem At All. In this podcast, we want to talk to political scientists about their research in the context of bigger developments in society and politics. We will have one guest per episode, and we base each episode around one or more papers that lie at the core of our guests' research interests. Us, that is the co-host, Julius Kölzer, and myself, Victor Bogi. Hi, Julius. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Victor. Welcome to the podcast. We are graduate students of political science based in Kiel and Zurich, and the idea of this podcast is to provide a platform so that insights of political science can reach a broader audience.
Today, we talk to Noam Gidron, who is associate professor at the Department of Political Science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Prior to that, he received his PhD from Harvard University and was a fellow at Princeton University.
Noam's research lies at the intersection of political behavior, political sociology, and political economy, and is especially known for its studies on so-called effective polarization and the link between social status and populism. In a new article, he and co-authors examine the roots of public support for the controversial judicial reforms in Israel introduced by the Netanyahu government, which sparked massive protests in 2023. Just to be clear, in this episode, we don't aim to talk about the ongoing war in Gaza. Noam is not a military expert and he does not do research on these topics. Rather, we are interested in the state of Israeli democracy and his related research on populism and effective polarization.
Welcome, Noam. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So, as Julius said, last year, Benjamin Netanyahu's hard right Likud government planned to push through a controversial judicial reform. And this sparked nationwide mass demonstrations and national strikes in Israel. And these reform plans included several measures that would weaken the system of checks and balances on the executive branch by granting the ruling coalition authority over the selection of judges and the power to overturn Supreme Court decisions. Together, these measures would contribute to democratic backsliding, which is a term used to describe the erosion of democratic institutions. In a new article, you and other co-authors are now investigating which attitudes explain public support for these plans. But maybe we can start with you giving us like an introduction, a broader picture. What are the origins and backgrounds of the judicial reforms? And what do they perhaps tell us about the state of Israeli democracy right now?
Yeah, I can preview some of the findings in the paper. You mentioned that we are looking at attitudes. We are also looking at emotions and affective evaluations. And that will turn out to be very important, but we'll get back to that in a moment. So just to put the last year in Israeli politics a little bit in context, Israel entered a period of intense political unrest in 2019. And Israelis went to the polls five times between 2019 and 2022. Following all these elections, no party was able to form a stable government that would last for long in power. And then in 2022, the right-wing bloc, exactly as you mentioned, Victor, won a majority with 64 seats in the Knesset out of 120. And Benjamin Netanyahu returned to the office of the prime minister, supported by a right-wing government, the most radical right-wing government that we had in the history of Israel. And then quickly after that, the government presented a comprehensive plan to reshape Israeli democracy, to concentrate power in the hands of the executive and weaken the courts. And the government followed what we've seen in other countries where democratically elected governments make efforts to weaken the system of checks and balances, and we are now referring to that as democratic backsliding or democratic erosion. So what we've seen here is not unlike similar processes we've witnessed in other countries, such as Hungary and Poland. And exactly as you mentioned, this reform effort was swiftly met with very intense opposition. The largest protest movement Israel has seen, and with Israeli taking to the streets week after week, month after month, protesting against the judicial overhaul, that was all in all not that popular among the Israeli public. So together with my colleagues, Yotam Margalit, Lior Sheffer, and Itamar Yakir from Tel Aviv University, we were all interested in better understanding who supported the judicial overhaul, or more broadly, who supports this type of reforms intended to advance democratic backsliding. And that was the research question motivating our work.
Okay, so you're getting right into your paper. Maybe one could also say that normally democratic backsliding is often considered as a process that is really driven by elite politicians and their decisions. But as you said, these reforms and these plans always require some support in the public to be implemented to. And the question you are investigating is really interesting in this regard. And I wonder if you can tell us broadly about the main findings you had in this regard. I mean, if I remember correctly, you had these five attitudinal dimensions that were important in explaining who supports actually these controversial plans. So maybe you can give us a better look into that.
So I think this is a crucial point that was recently emphasized by political scientist Larry Bartel. And the key issue here that the process of democratic backsliding is often initiated by political elites who seek to concentrate power in their hand. But because we are talking about democratic backsliding as a process that takes place within a democratic system, it also requires constructing some kind of support coalition for these types of reforms. And we wanted to better understand this support coalition without contesting the overarching argument that the process was initiated by political elites. Okay, so I think this is crucial. And then we went back to the comparative politics literature on this issue, and we wanted to identify the key arguments, the key narratives that have been proposed by scholars to understand who in the public supports this type of reforms. And what we noticed is that in different bodies of literature, American politics, European political behavior, etc., different scholars tend to emphasize different types of arguments. So we thought that it would be important to first try and bring together these different narratives, different arguments into a comprehensive framework that then could also be used by scholars of democratic backsliding, or more specifically, scholars of mass support for democratic backsliding in other countries. So going over this body of literature, these are the key arguments that we identified. First, we focus on how people feel, how strongly they are attached to the leaders who advance this type of democratic backsliding processes. And we know that voters tend to follow their leaders, right? Voters tend to adopt the positions of their preferred leaders. And we know that also many countries have undergone processes of personalization in which specific leaders carry more weight in the political arena. So our first argument is that people who are more strongly attached to the leader, in our case, people who are more strongly attached to Netanyahu, are more likely to support the reform, all else being equal. Now, then we also have a lot of literature, not just about how much the public is attached to the preferred leader, but also how much people dislike political opponents, right? So we are kind of like shifting the perspective. It may be not that I'm a huge fan of my side, but I really strongly dislike and fear and resent my political opponents, right? And here work by Milan Slovic is very influential. We have some evidence from the US suggesting that indeed people who are very strongly affectively polarized, that is, they harbor very negative feelings toward political opponents, will be more likely to support democratic transgression. Then in our case, the more strongly Netanyahu's voters or supporters dislike parties of the center and the left, the more likely they are to support the judicial overhaul. So we have this emotional, affective evaluations type of variable. Then we also have two attitudinal variables. The first is populist attitudes it's hard not to talk about populism when thinking about democratic backsliding. We know it is such an important feature of contemporary politics, and many, if not all, of the government that have been accused in advancing processes of democratic backsliding are also considered populist. Think about examples in Hungary and Poland, right? So we wanted to see whether there's an association between populist attitude, that is, dislike of the elites, understanding politics as a moral battle between the elites and the unified people, and support for democratic backsliding. Okay, our fourth narrative is closely related to populism, but also analytically and theoretically distinct. Populists talk about the people as a unified entity, right? A closely related concept is that of majoritarianism. Those for whom democracy is decision by the majority of the people. So you don't have to think about the people as a unified entity, but what matters here is that you have the support of the majority of the voters, and whatever they decide is democratic. And that, of course, stands in opposition to a liberal conception of democracy that also considers checks and balances on the will of the majority. And here it's also important to note that Netanyahu and his government presented and advocated for the judicial overhaul in majoritarian terms, right? Making the case that this is what the majority of the people want, and that's what we should care about, not what the courts decide. So that was part of the public discussion. Then we added the fifth and last narrative or argument, which turns to people's personal experiences. We know from research in political economy and political behavior more broadly that people's own personal experiences in the market or with other people around them can shape political attitudes. And here specifically, we wanted to examine whether people who had negative experiences with law enforcing authorities will be more likely to support a plan that weakens the court. And here again, we wanted to take seriously arguments made by proponents of the judicial argument, and they were making the case that the judicial system is dysfunctional. And that's why, according to their perspective, it requires such a deep reform. And we wanted to examine whether indeed people who had such negative experiences with the law would be more likely to support the judicial overhaul. So sorry, I was talking for a long time, but I thought it was important to bring together the five different narratives because, of course, we are focusing on a unique case, on Israel. But we think that this framework could be helpful also in examining mass support for democratic backsliding in other countries.
Of course, yeah.
And does this framework prove to be effective in predicting this support? What do you find in the paper?
So some of these variables turn out to be much more important than others in explaining support for the judicial overhaul. Maybe I can just say a word about methodology without going into too much detail, just to...
That's fine. We're the podcast for these things here. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So we in order to examine the predictive power or the explanatory power of these different arguments, we are using panel data. And that's important for our research design because we measure these predictors before the judicial overhaul was presented to the public. And then we went back to the same people, that is, the same respondents of the previous survey, and then asked them whether they support or oppose the judicial overhaul. So we can say that concerns about reversed causality, right? Whether people would, provide answers regarding populism or majoritarianism based on the discourse that surrounded the judicial overhaul, that's less of a concern for us. So we are using panel data, which I think provides us with a very strong methodological framework to examine the explanatory power of these different arguments.
So to the empirical findings?
Okay. Now to the most important part, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what we find is that the affect-related variables are the strongest predictors of support for the judicial overhaul. Specifically, when we zoom in, when we focus on voters who supported the government, right? The people who voted for coalition parties, there we find that the more they dislike political opponents, that is, parties of the center and the left, and the more strongly they are attached emotionally to Netanyahu, the more likely they are to support the judicial overhaul. So affective evaluations do a lot of work here in explaining who supports the judicial overhaul. Then we find that a majoritarian understanding of democracy, that is an understanding of democracy as reflecting the will of the majority, more so than a system of government shaped by checks and balances, that also predict to a certain degree support for the judicial overhaul, though less than the affective evaluation. Entanglement with the law, that is negative experience with the judicial system, is also predictive to a certain degree, and a populist understanding of democracy, and that is the populist worldview that so many of us, including myself, have examined very closely, that is not predictive of support. It could be because we are not measuring it very well, and I can say more about it later on, but it is not highly predictive of support for the judicial overhaul. So all in all, another way of putting it, is what we find is that there was no very strong mass level demand for the judicial overhaul. It's not like people had a very strong populist and majoritarian worldview, and that's why they demanded from their leadership this type of reform. Instead, once the reform was presented, it was supported by people who very strongly like Netanyahu and very strongly dislike the center and the left. I think it goes back to the point you made before about the role of elites in initiating this process, but once the proposal is on the table, the degree of affective evaluation, how much you dislike opponents, matters a lot.
And just to go back to this methodological question before this, to explain it to those who aren't so much into political methodology, maybe.
Sure,
so this
sure,
is important.
Yeah.
This is why it's important to have panel data, right, to track this change within a person over time and not just take a time point after the actual event and then measure different attitudes. This is very biased.
Exactly. Because, Victor, let's say that I'm asking you about your view regarding the judicial overhaul after it was already presented, right? And then I'm also asking you whether you think about democracy in majoritarian or populist terms. And if I'm asking you these questions after the reform was already presented, maybe your views about democracy are already shaped by what you think about the plan, about the judicial overhaul. And here we are not concerned about it because we asked these questions before, actually just hours before the plan was announced. So we were also a little bit lucky to run the panel just before the judicial overhaul was presented. No one knew, or at least many didn't know, that this was going to be announced at this exact time. So yes, it is useful to collect panel data, and also it's helpful to be a little bit lucky.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, the decisions of elites are really important in forming public opinion. And parts of Netanyahu government that is in power are also two orthodox, ultra-orthodox parties and a smaller alliance of religious Zionist parties that occupies important cabinet positions and is, I would say, ideologically strongly in support of implementing the Jewish religion as the dominant religion in Israel, right? And also these parties have supported annexation and the settlement of the West Bank. And I mean, at least I had the perception that the Israeli Supreme Court was always sort of a defender of the democratic system as a whole and was sort of blocking policies that was in the interest of these ultra-religious parties. For example, there were some decisions by the Supreme Court blocking certain parts of the settlement policy in the West Bank. And I was wondering, in regard of your paper, what role do these religious interests or religious identities have in explaining support or opposition to the judicial reforms?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and there's a lot to unpack here. We do find, when we look at support for the judicial overhaul by parties, we do find very strong support for the judicial overhaul among voters of the far-right religious Zionism party and the ultra-Orthodox parties. Support there is significantly stronger than among voters of the Likud. I think we want to be cautious about idealizing the Israeli Supreme Court. That being said, I do think that you are correct at pointing at this multiply motivated coalition or alliance of political actors who could potentially benefit from weakening the courts. We know that the settlement movement perceived the courts as a constraint on the effort of territorial expansion in the West Bank. And we know that for the ultra-Orthodox parties, the Supreme Court is, again, a constraint on the demand for preferential treatment in terms of welfare policies, as well as the exemption from military service. This is something that is currently debated in the Supreme Court. And we can also mention here Netanyahu specifically and his inner circle. Netanyahu is facing criminal charges of bribery and breach of trust, and he also has potentially something to benefit from weakening the court. So we have here a coalition of at the elite level of different actors who could benefit from weakening the Supreme Court. And I guess it would remain for historians to better understand exactly how much each of these groups, you can think about them as intense policy demanders, how much they influence the decision to put forth the judicial overhaul. Our emphasis is about mass support.
If you historically look at countries which shifted from democracies to autocracies, there's often been emphasized in research the role of the big conservative parties and how they behave towards the radical right extremists. And now I was wondering a bit about the role of Likud here. Is it still a conservative party? Would you already classify them as being far right themselves? And then how do you see their role maybe in general in terms of democratic backsliding in Israel?
Yeah, of course. That speaks to an important body of literature, and Daniel Ziblatt's work on conservative mainstream right parties is, of course, highly influential in this regard. And here I can point to an interesting data point. So Israel was very recently added to the Chapel Hill Expert Survey. For listeners who are not closely familiar with it, it's a highly useful data set that allows us to compare parties' positions on multiple dimensions based on expert scores. Of course, it's not without limitations, but it's very useful if we want to get a sense of how parties are located on different issues compared to parties abroad. And again, Israel was just recently added to this data set. So maybe we want to wait a little bit before we can identify long-term trends. But it's interesting to know that if we focus on the degree to which parties attack political elites and the establishment, which is a proxy, in my view, for populism, not a perfect measure, but a proxy for how much populism matters in a political party's public appeal, here we see that the Likud is a significant outlier when compared to European mainstream parties. It is much more populist, or at least it gives a much stronger role to attacks against elite and the establishment compared to mainstream center-right parties in Europe. And it is, in fact, much closer to the populism of European far-right parties. So I don't think that would surprise people who closely follow Israeli politics. although the Likud had been in power for a very long time, and Netanyahu is Israel's longest serving prime minister, it's very clear that attacks against the elites play a prominent role in this party's political discourse. But now, using the chess data, we can actually compare it also to other countries, and it's clear that the Likud is an outlier. It's much more similar to far-right parties than mainstream European right parties.
But I was wondering in this regard, I mean, of course it helps us to explain why Likud attacks democratic institutions and saying, okay, they're highly populist. But as you said, this wasn't always the case. I mean, there was a change over time. And I was wondering, what explains this change, right? Why did Likud shift so hard to the populist side? What are your takes on this?
Yeah, I think this is an issue that would be examined very closely in the coming years. I do think it's important to emphasize that there were populist segments or populist roots for the Likud that go way back in time, right? I don't think it's a completely new phenomenon. And there have been work about populism and the Israeli right. For a while, Danny Filk has written extensively on this topic. I think the question is at what point it has become from one feature of the party to a dominant feature of the party. And I think that's a very important question. One way of thinking about it is the degree to which the Likud has become dependent on coalition partners, such as the far right, religious Zionism party, and the ultra-Orthodox parties, that have the policy-based interest in weakening the courts. And another direction for inquiry on this topic is focusing on the Likud itself. And here I think it matters in which direction Netanyahu has pushed the party. And since he's been implicated in legal accusations, I think we've seen greater attacks against the political establishment. It also matters who is the selectorate, that is, who participates in the primaries of the Likud party, who selects the list of the members of the Knesset. I think these are all interrelated directions for future work on this topic. But I do think it's important to emphasize that rather than thinking about populism as a new feature of the Israeli right, we should ask, at which point and why did it become more or less prominent?
In regard to the literature you referenced from Daniel Ziblatt and so on, I mean, as always said that conservative parties such as Likud was have sort of a gatekeeper function. I think Victor already mentioned this term. And in this case, I was wondering, is this term really fitting? Because gatekeeper really implies that the conservative party protects or should protect attacks from outside the mainstream right. Like, for example, in Weimar Republic in Germany, it's always said that back then the conservative parties lost the gatekeeping function because they weren't able to protect the system from attacks from the National Socialists. But in this case, it's the conservative party themselves that turned, and the party themselves that attacked the system, and not the attacks not coming from outside, right?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think both true. In several European countries, we've seen this debate about whether the mainstream right should work with more populist parties. And what we've seen in Israel is that the mainstream, the main party of the right itself has become populist to the bone. Again, there are also examples from other countries, and I think the Republican Party, of course, comes to mind, right? It's a case of a governing central party on the right that has become increasingly populist. Also, other things become increasingly authoritarian, nativist, right? So it's not a unique case in which a conservative party has transformed into a populist party, and to some degree also a movement. But yes, it's definitely not just a case in which they are cooperating in power with populist parties. They are populists themselves.
Now, in the book The Tyranny of the Minority by Ziblatt and Levitsky, when we're speaking about the US, they propose some major institutional reforms because they say this is big problem within the US right now, that the Constitution basically does not fit the state of society anymore. And do you think this is transferable to Israel to some extent? Is this more like an institutional problem, or should we look in other directions there?
I definitely think there is an institutional dimension here, although Israel is very different from the US. In a way, it's almost the opposite, right? So some are concerned that in the US, it's too hard to change the constitution, right? There are too many veto points, making it harder for the majority to rule. Israel, institutionally, is located perhaps on the other side of this imagined spectrum of veto points, right? Because there is no fixed constitution, no clear and final Bill of Rights. So I do think there's definitely an institutional component here that we can read Levitsky and Ziblatt to think more about this issue, but the type of solution that they propose for the US would not necessarily fit the Israeli context because the institutional terrain is so different.
And I mean, in your article, you mentioned some reforms that could be implemented in order to protect the institutions better. For example, it's about the electoral law, about federalism and so on. What are ways or what are steps that would work in the Israeli context?
Yeah, of course, that's a very big question. And currently, the public debate is not necessarily focused on these specific issues. With everything going on in the region, I think that there's definitely a place to codify the relationship between the Knesset, the legislature, and the Supreme Court. You don't have to support the judicial overhaul in order to support a law that would clarify the relationship between the different branches. And there are also reforms in the electoral system that one can consider. For instance, bringing in a regional component into the electoral system in order to create regional bases of power. So there are all these different institutional changes to the system that I hope will be seriously considered. Yeah, a lot on the table to consider.
So what I was wondering is about when now we spoke a lot about the mainstream right or the far right, and yes, also the institutional setup in Israel. What about the mainstream left, the opposition? How do they behave in the current situation?
Very poorly, to put it shortly. The opposition is divided. Not unlike what we've seen in other countries where you had a very strong populist right in power. It's divided between a more centrist faction, a slightly more leftist part, more liberal, and there are also parties who mostly represent Arab citizens of Israel, who were part of the previous government. But the position within the Israeli party system is different. So the opposition has found it really hard to find a message which can bring it all together. Some parts of the coalition are more willing, of the opposition, sorry, are more willing than others to work with Netanyahu specifically, since the Hamas attack on October 7th and the war that erupted in Gaza. So the opposition is really struggling to speak in a unified voice and find a message that could bring it all its different factions together.
Could you talk a little bit more about the role of the conflict since October? How did it again change the discussion also around the judicial reforms, but also more generally in Israeli inner like politics?
Yeah, so much has happened in Israel in 2023 that it's almost impossible to cover it all, not only in one podcast, right, in a series of podcasts. Currently, we can say that the judicial overhaul is not formally part of, or it's not formally high on the political agenda, right? It has been pushed to the side. But many believe, including myself, that while it's no longer front and center, different members of the government still try to incrementally advance different parts of the judicial overhaul, in some cases also taking advantage of the fact that public attention is now focused on the war rather on these type of somewhat complicated, intricate judicial matters. So if when the government was just established, the goal was to push forward this huge package of laws that would really very deeply restructure Israeli democracy, it seems like now they shifted to a more incremental approach. So I think that this issue is still to some degree shaping Israeli politics, although in more elusive ways.
I just had the feeling that during the mass protests, this whole protest were not only driven by people from the left side of the political spectrum and unions and so on, but also people from the military protesting against these reforms. And I was wondering, would you say that Likud, or maybe also Netanyahu specifically, lost some electoral support, some support in the public because of these reforms, and maybe they regained sort of the support during the war? Or would you say that Likud has maybe lost some voters to the liberal parties because of this, their plans to overhaul the system?
Yeah, again, there's a lot to unpack here, but we know that the reform was unpopular also among some Likud voters. It had a support of about 2/3 of the voters. So it's still a majority of Likud voters, but there was also a significant group of voters who didn't like the judicial overhaul and defected from the Likud to more centrist parties. Then following the Hamas attack on October 7th and the war in Gaza, it's interesting not only what happened, but also to notice what didn't happen. And what didn't happen was a rally around the flag effect. We didn't see mass support among opposition voters to Netanyahu following the attack, which is perhaps a little bit surprising because following such catastrophic events, think about 9/11, right? We often see a huge spike in support for those in power. And we haven't seen that. In fact, the government has lost support. At least according to the current polls, it does not enjoy a majority. It did gain some support back in the last few weeks, but still, we know that many voters have defected. Now, it's important to say they may come back to the Likud before the next election, so we shouldn't jump into conclusions, but we indeed saw that there was no this rally around the flag effect, perhaps surprisingly.
Do you think Netanyahu specifically misassessed the situation after the attacks in October and then was expecting, this rally around the flag effect to happen also in terms of support for the war?
Honestly, I don't know what he had in mind. I'm not in a position to comment on that, I guess. I think that the Israeli public has been so effectively polarized on October that it was almost impossible to bring everyone together, even after such a catastrophic event. What Netanyahu exactly had in mind, I'm not the right person to ask.
Could you elaborate maybe a little bit more on the effect of polarization after last October?
So maybe we want to put it in a broader context together with two colleagues, Yair Amitai and Omer Yair. I've been tracking changes in affective polarization in Israeli society for a long time. And what we've seen is that since Netanyahu entered office in 2009, there was an increase in out-party dislike among supporters of the two main parties. That's what we have data for a relatively long period of time. There was an increase in out-party dislike, which reached a peak in the 2022 election. So put it differently, by 2022, Israel was more highly polarized than at any moment before in the previous 30 years, for which we have data. And then came the judicial overhaul, right, which sparked the largest protest movement, and then the war. So there was this succession of highly polarizing events. According to data that I've seen, there was no significant decline in affective polarization following October 7th and the war in Gaza, which I think is interesting. But I think here we still need to collect some more data in order to be really confident.
But was there a decline in affective polarization during the reforms or right after the reforms? Because as you said, there were like a lot of people also from the Likud party supporters that were against these reforms.
Yeah, according to what I've seen, there wasn't a significant decline in affective polarization with everything that was going on, but this is something that we would still need to examine in the future.
And you said that even before the planned reforms, society was so highly polarized or effectively polarized. So you would say you're drawing on many years now of research on the topic that you've done. This fits into the general picture, which we can see in other Western democracies too.
To a certain degree, I think that Israel differs slightly from other countries. Actually, I have in mind the US rather than just the European case. Because here we've seen, here in Israel, I mean, we've seen affective polarization increases, but also decreases in certain years, right? So we usually think about partisan resentment and dislike as something that has gradually increased across the globe, say, in the last 30 or so years. And analyzing data from Israel, what we've seen is that affective polarization, that is dislike between political opponents, across party lines, it has increased in the 90s, which were a tumultuous time period here in Israel with the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin and the Oslo Accord. But then, interestingly, during the first decade of the 2000s, we've actually witnessed a decline in affective polarization. And that was a period of coalitions bringing together the main parties on both the left and right. And here we also have evidence from European countries that serving together in government can help reduce affective polarization between supporters of parties that are together in coalition. And indeed, we've seen a decline in affective polarization first decade of the 2000s, but then since Netanyahu re-entered the prime minister office in 2009, we've seen an increase in out-party dislike. Interestingly, so affective polarization is often measured as the difference between how much I like my own party and how much I dislike the opposing party. And the increase in affective polarization we witnessed since 2009 is mostly driven not by greater in-party positive feeling, but by greater out-party dislike. And we also have data specifically on affective polarization, affective evaluations of Netanyahu. And here again, we can see that feelings have really polarized regarding Netanyahu specifically as a leader since 2009.
Okay, maybe coming to an end, I was wondering if you could give us an outlook, sort of, what is going to happen with this whole reform of the judicial system about democratic backsliding overall. Do you believe this issue is going to be less discussed if the war will end in some time? Or do you think that this is going to be an ongoing issue that's also going to be part of discussions in 10 years or something?
I definitely think it's going to be an ongoing issue. I think that many of us who protested against the judicial overhaul should be aware that it is still on the table, even if presented differently. I think that social scientists will examine this process for many years to come. 2023 was an extremely intense year in Israeli politics, and its implications we can now see across the region to a certain degree. So I think this is definitely something that we will still be talking about in 10 years.
Okay. Thank you very much for this outlook at the end, Noam, and thank you for speaking about your research. It was very insightful, and thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This was the 5th episode of No Problem At All. If you're interested in Noam's work more generally, we post a link to the papers we talked about in this episode in the podcast description. You can also follow him on social media.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast and rate it on Spotify or wherever you listen to this. This helps us to promote the podcast. We are also happy to receive feedback, so consider following us on Twitter via the links in the podcast description or send us an email. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Bye.